I'd like to begin by talking about Governor Beshear's tax reform plans. He unveiled them this year, and he's proposing to boost tax revenue by an estimated $210 million annually by lowering income and corporate taxes and adding new taxes to some services. How are lawmakers responding?
It depends on, again, who you ask. Democrats and Republicans so far are kind of tight-lipped about it. Beshear has asked them to reach a consensus on this plan. So in the absence of meetings that have really yet to occur between leadership in both chambers, some people are saying, Stumbo supports most ideas in the plan. Stivers is more reticent. But House Floor Leader Jeff Hoover, a Republican, he has called for, closed-door meetings to sort of hash all of this out because, in a perfect world, these could be transparent conversations. The public could sort of hear the process being debated, ideas being exchanged. But the consequence of that is if a lawmaker would even suggest a certain proposal or tax, then they could sort of be pinned as an advocate for that without even really necessarily advocating it. So it's a very politically sensitive issue. Hoover has sort of pushed back against that. He just sort of believes that, the conversations that need to happen in order to reach a consensus have to sort of be away from the public eye for the sake of efficiency. But, there is a public interest in sort of figuring out where lawmakers stand on this, and by and large, they don't want new taxes, but we're probably not going to really know until these meetings are conducted. Generally, they applaud the idea. Hoover himself is very supportive of it. Everybody seems to be a supporter of tax reform, but no one is really discussing what that reform should look like.
Hmm. I'd like to go back to those negotiations and holding them behind closed doors. This obviously raises a couple of questions. Is that legal, one? And two, what are the odds that it will happen?
It's most likely going to happen. The budgetary process itself, which is the main charge of this General Assembly, this year is to craft a budget, and that is normally conducted in large part. You have above the board negotiations in appropriations and revenue committees, but there are also just conversations either in offices of leadership just to sort of coordinate the kind of support for certain proposals, and I think that absolutely applies to tax reform. As far as the legality, that's an excellent question. As far as I know, they are allowed to conduct these conversations behind closed doors. Hoover has said that once they have sort of hammered out in private the nucleus of tax reform, then they will bring it into the traditional committee process where it will be debated, in a public capacity. The main concern is just sort of a watchdog issue. When the ideas are presented in the committee, they will have already been hashed out in private. And so those are the kind of conversations that will likely involve, horse trading, capitulation, things like that, that will not be seeing the light of day. Hmm. So it's mainly an ethical concern.
Well, in order to tax, you have to have something to tax, and that speaks to wages. And the House passed Speaker Greg Stumbo's minimum wage bill this week. The bill would gradually increase the minimum wage from $7.25 to $10.10 an hour. What was the debate on the measure like?
Well, the vote came down largely along party lines. You had a few defectors in both parties sort of either supporting or opposing it. And whenever you have that kind of contentious bill, it's going to draw out contentious debate. And the debate largely centered on Republicans sort of charging that if you raise the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour, any kind of wage to that degree that they increase is going to put an undue burden on businesses. House Floor Leader Hoover said as much in his speech, but on the opposing side, Democrats say that, the 95-cent increase phased in each year over to 2016 is not going to impact businesses as much as Republicans are saying, and there was debate between Hoover and House Speaker Stumbo on that point. Hoover sort of conceding that some of his numbers weren't exactly what he wanted them to be. The most incendiary comments came from Louisville Representative Jim Wayne, whom essentially took the opportunity to discuss not only Kentucky's but America's, you know, rampant income inequality and just sort of couch the issue in terms of it's a moral obligation. Wayne is a business owner, and he said that if you cannot treat your employees well, if you can't afford a 95-cent increase each year or the next couple of years, then you should probably go back to business school. So it is. It was definitely framed a moral issue on one side. You know, families in Kentucky are suffering, versus that this would actually have an adverse effect on businesses.
What are its chances in the Senate?
It's actually coupled, from what I understand, the talks that are going on right now between leadership in both chambers is that potentially the fate of the minimum wage bill, which would also include pay equity for women, it is tethered to the Senate's signature piece of legislation, which is admittedly wonky. Stivers is sort of bucked against this idea that this quid pro quo that, you know, the Senate will pass minimum wage hikes in exchange for the Senate's pet bill, which would essentially strip the governor's office of its ability to implement certain regulations.
And that bill has generated a little bit of controversy. Could you tell us about it and what are its odds of passing the House?
Well, you know, it remains to be seen as far as the odds go if how tethered it is going to be to the fate of the House's minimum wage bill. But like the debate that centered on House Bill 1, it fell along party lines, and therefore it drew very heated debate. Essentially, it involves mainly Senate Republicans who feel that the governor's office has too much power to implement regulations such as, and these were cited on the floor debate, the Affordable Care Act's implementation, Common Core school standards, that these were promulgated and implemented by the executive branch. And Senate Republicans feel that they're being left out of this process. Senator Damon Thayer of Georgetown argued that the Affordable Care Act was essentially a tax that the legislature was not able to even vote on or have much say in, because at the end of the day, Beshear did what he wanted to do because it was in his constitutional authority to do so. It will be a constitutional amendment that would go before voters in November if the House does indeed pass it and it's signed into law. But Senator Julian Carroll, a former governor himself, argued, and you have to sort of take that into consideration. As a former governor, he was integral to sort of coalescing power in that executive branch. But he argued that we have a system of checks and balances, and that if Senate Republicans have a problem with the Affordable Care Act, they should take the governor's office to court, that the current system is working fine. Don't change it if you don't like certain things that the governor does, essentially.
Well, it is interesting that, you know, the governor's office has had this power for quite some time, but it is after the Affordable Care Act, after Common Core, that the question really arises. The timing is quite interesting.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, there are quite a few. I think there's an election going on.
I hear something about that.
And I would assume that this kind of rhetoric, which has been going on, I mean, since session began, there have been, Senate President Stivers made sort of this wide-ranging floor speech not too long ago, sort of invoking his dissatisfaction with the governor's office to implement these regulations and its effect on everything from, you know, the Affordable Care Act and what he claims are about 168,000 people who have had their policies canceled, which is not entirely true, to its effect on the coal industry. That's a whole other can of worms. But yeah, there's a lot of heated rhetoric going on about these issues that Republicans are very critical of. And this bill would allow them to sort of actually address it. But aside from that, it's just a lot of talk in an election season.
Well, the Senate's also considering a bill allowing people under domestic violence protections, emergency access to carry concealed weapons. Can you give us some background on this bill?
Sure. This is filed by Senator Jared Carpenter. It passed a Senate Judiciary Committee this week. The overview of this bill is that if a victim of domestic violence gets an emergency protective order, an EPO, from a judge, then that person can apply to that court with the approval of their respective sheriff and a subsequent background check for a concealed carry permit. This would be good for within 90 days of getting that EPO, and it would allow the victim to carry concealed a firearm ostensibly for the purposes of defending themselves against their, you know, accused abuser. I had a chance to speak with Carpenter. He essentially calls it just sort of common sense that it allows people to protect themselves. But the main issue that was raised during the debate in committee was the issue of training. In order to get a concealed carry weapons permit in Kentucky and most places, I mean, you have to go through the training course, and it can take up to 8 to 10 hours. Some of them can be more involved, and this does not address that. And the assumption is that the people who would apply for this already own a firearm, and therefore they're well-versed with the responsibilities that gun ownership entails.
Lastly, tell us about this bill filed by Senator Julie Denton regarding cannabis oil.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, actually I should say about a month ago, there was a Senate Health and Welfare Committee hearing that witnessed testimony from people who are ailing from certain, specifically neurological illnesses, that, and they claim, and there appears to be quite a growing body of peer-reviewed scientific literature that is suggesting that cannabis oil, which is an extract of sorts from the cannabis plant, the marijuana plant, that is very low in THC, which is the psychoactive ingredient that gets people high when they smoke marijuana. It's very low in that, but it contains a chemical compound called cannabidol, and that essentially, they claim, alleviates symptoms from neurological disorders, seizures. I've had a chance to speak with a mother of an 8-month-old who suffers from chronic seizures, and you can apparently order this stuff off of Amazon. Well, this mother was saying that she was able to use this oil, and it's really helping her daughter, but she can't get it through her insurance because it's currently illegal in Kentucky, and so she's considering moving to Colorado, which, as you probably know, has the most liberal marijuana laws in the nation, if not the world. And so this bill would essentially allow doctors to prescribe this cannabis oil to patients for various neurological disorders.
Any pushback?
Well, it's an education campaign. Denton has said that in order for this to work, the focus needs to be narrow. She doesn't want it to get lumped into the broader issue of medicinal marijuana, which it has more, I guess you could say, negative connotations among certain segments of the population. So, yeah, she says that by keeping it narrow, just focusing on the cannabis oil, and just having the testimony of people for whom that this drug helps alleviate pain and allows them to live normal lives, she believes that that will result in minimal pushback. But she just introduced this bill a couple of days ago. It has not even, as far as I know, been signed to a committee yet. So it remains to be seen what the pushback is going to be. But again, anything related to marijuana, it's still a controversial topic in most states, and Kentucky is no exception. So we'll see.
Indeed we will. Jonathan Meter is Kentucky Public Radio's Capitol Bureau reporter. Jonathan, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.